And St. Thomas, aware of this, said that the divine wisdom was above all to be compared with games, because games are played for their own sake and not for any sort of ulterior motive. So also music is a kind of non-purposive thing, because you don't either play music to reach a destination, nor do you dance to reach a particular place on the floor. It is the doing of it itself that is important, because after all, if the object of music were to gain a certain destination, those orchestras that played fastest would be considered the best. So the idea is that that dancing and music, more than other arts, represent the nature of this world. That it is playful, that it is sport. That it may be sincere, but is definitely not serious. And as G.K. Chesterton well put it once, the angels fly because they take themselves lightly. How much more so the Lord of the Angels. So if a beautiful lady should say to me, "I love you," and I were to reply, "Are you serious or are you just playing with me?" That would be quite the wrong response, because I hope she's not serious and that she will play with me. I should say, "Are you sincere or are you just toying with me?" Because you see, the word play has many different senses. A person who is playing the organ in church is certainly not doing something trivial. When you go to see a play called Hamlet, you are not seeing something trivial. When the concert artist plays Mozart, he is certainly entertaining you, but it's not a trivial entertainment. But on the other hand, we would use play in quite a different sense when we mean just fooling around, doing it for kicks. So it is fundamental, as a matter of fact, to both the Hindu and the Christian traditions that the universe is the play of God. But the Christian thinks of it in the terms of a construction play, like building with blocks. And the Hindu thinks of it as dramatic play, of the actual participation of the Godhead in the creation, so that every being whatsoever is God in disguise. Hinduism speaks of the Godhead as, uses the word Brahman. This is a neuter form in Sanskrit from the root brih, which means to grow, to expand, to swell. The neuter form Brahman does not have quite the connotation then, you see, of kingship that we will find attached to the Western idea of God, but is also referred to as Atman. And this word we translate ordinarily the self. So you can have the para param, you put the M in to connect the particle, paramatman, which means para, the supreme self, or sometimes just the Atman alone, and that means the self in you. But the fundamental principle of Indian philosophy is Atman is Brahman. Yourself is the supreme self. Or it is expressed also in the formula Tat Tvam Asi. Colloquially translated, you're it. Or Tat, that, Tuvam, Latin Tuam, you, Asi, are. You are that thou art. Tat, of course, is the first word uttered by a baby. Ta, 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 ta. And fathers flatter themselves that it's saying da-da. It's not. It's saying that. Da, 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 da. And so it's pointing to thatness in everything. It's very important to see this. Because everything is just that. I can say it in a negative way, which you won't appreciate at first, perhaps. Everything is meaningless. Only words have meaning, because they point to something other than themselves. The sound water is undrinkable, but it points to the drinkable reality. When you say, though, what is that pointing at the water, and somebody says water, he's not being correct, because what you're pointing at is not the noise water. So it's not water. It's that. Da. And water's a kind of jazz. And it's just doing that. You can get to see, too, people are a kind of jazz. They talk and communicate with each other, but what does that mean? Well, they get together and they make more people and they do this and they do that and they eat and they go on doing this jazz, but it's just jazz. And you begin to see, as you do that, everything's like music, you see. It's all these complicated vibrations going ka-choo-ka-choo-ka-choo-ka-choo-ka-choo-ka-choo-ka-choo-ka-choo-ka-choo-ka-choo-ka-choo in all kinds of ways. That's that, or that-ness, ta-ta-ta, also called in Sanskrit. So anyway, this is the fundamental notion that you are really what there is, the works. Only you're playing hide-and-seek with yourself. And on a stupendous scale. Hindus measure time in units which in Sanskrit are called kalpa. And a kalpa is a period of 4,320,000 years. And there are two kinds of kalpa. One is called manvantara, and the other is called pralaya. Manvantara is the kalpa in which the universe is manifested, in other words, in which God puts on his big act. And pralaya is the succeeding kalpa in which the universe is unmanifested. And the Godhead does not dream, but is awake to its own nature. These are called, respectively, the days and the nights of the Brahman. And this goes on forever and ever and ever and ever. The days and nights adding up into years and centuries and eons. They speak of crore. There's a Sanskrit measure, crore, C-R-O-R-E. A sort of a word that really, I think, means umpteen. Crores of kalpas. And this is the in-breathing and the out-breathing. There's the word hamsa. And this word in Sanskrit, hamsa, means a swan or a big water bird, like a gander. There's a myth that there is in the beginning the divine bird which lays the egg of the world. And the egg splits, and the upper is the heavens, and the lower is the earth. So when the worlds are manifested, the Lord breathing out says, hung. And when the worlds are withdrawn, the breath comes back, hung. But if you say hung sa hung sa hung sa hung, it becomes sa hung sa hung. Sa ahung. Sa means that, the truth, ahung, I am that. It's like, imagine, when we get to the final moment in which the world is blown up. You know, imagine the countdown. This is the end. Somebody's pushed the button. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. What are you listening to? Sound of the waves. And you can sit and listen to the little waves on the seashore. And you get back here into this kind of thinking and you're hearing the ocean of the universe going. And that's your breathing too. It's all one rhythm. So it may be that every star was once a planet populated by intelligent people who found out about the fundamental energy of the universe and blew themselves up. And as they blew up, they scattered all kinds of stuff out which became little planets. Which in a long time, life started all over again. Because the Hindu theory is very odd. Every kalpa in the Manvantara period, where there's a manifested world, is divided into four subdivisions of time, each one of which is called a yuga. That means roughly an epoch or an era. And there are four yugas, and they're named after the different throws in the Indian game of dice. There are four such throws, and the first is called Krita. That means, Kri means to do, as when we say something is done, truly done. It's the perfect throw of four. The second is called Treta, which is the throw of three. The next is called Dvapara, which is the throw of two. And the final one is called Kali, which means the worst throw, which is the throw of one. Now, each of these periods of the Kalpa are of different lengths. Krita is the longest, and Kali is the shortest, and so ranged. So that when the world is first manifested, as in those dreams that I were mentioning to you, the world is in a golden age to begin with. It's perfect. And that is the longest period of time. Then when we get a little bit more adventurous, you see, Treta means that in this era, a kind of disharmonious element enters into things. It's like a three-legged chair isn't so secure as a four-legged chair. It's just a bit inclined to tip. And as it were, as a fly in the ointment, the snake in the garden. Then comes Dvapara, in which the forces of good and evil are equally balanced. And finally, Kali, which is the shortest period, where the forces of evil are triumphant, and the world is destroyed at the end of it. For then the Godhead appears in the form of Shiva, who represents the destructive aspect of the divine energy, and whereas Brahma is the creative, Vishnu the preserver, Shiva the destroyer. But Shiva is always the destroyer in the sense of the liberator, the guy who breaks up the ruts. And he comes on with a blue body and 10 arms and a necklace of skulls. Indian gods have many arms because they are cosmic centipedes. They do all things without having to think about it, like the centipede doesn't have to think about how to manipulate its legs, like you don't have to think how to grow your hair. And as Shiva dances what is called the Tandava, which is the dance of destruction at the end of the cycle, at the end of the Kalpa, you will see that his hands contain clubs and knives and bells, but one hand is like that. And that gesture means, don't be afraid, it's a big act. It is all, as it were, the outflowing of your own consciousness, of your own mind. Now then, the Hindu life is related to this cosmology. And the objective of life is, of course, in the end, to wake up from the dream when you've had enough. And so the dreaming process is called sometimes samsara. Samsara is the round, the rat race. And samsara is divided into 6 divisions. I better draw a map, I think. This is common, you see, cosmology to both the Hindus and the Buddhists. This is the world of the Deva. And this is the same root from which we get both divine and devil. But deva means angel. The highest and most successful beings in the universe. And so opposite, this is the world of Naraka, who are the most unsuccessful. These are the purgatorial worlds of extreme suffering. This is the world of Asura. They are also angels, but they're angry angels, representing the wrath potential of energy. This is the world of animals. This is the world of preta, for which we have no English equivalent. They are hungry or frustrated spirits who have enormous stomachs but mouths only the size of needles. Vast appetite and no means of fulfillment. And this is the Manu world, that is to say, the world of man. You don't have to take this literally. You could say, when you are extremely happy or ecstatic, you're here. When you are miserable, you're here. When you're dumb, you're here. When you're mad, you're here. When you're frustrated, you're here. But when you're more or less your normal, rational self, you're here. Now, so all life through the period of the kalpas goes grinding around this wheel. And if you go up and you succeed and you get to the top, you have to come down. They don't see success, in other words, in the world as a method of liberation because it implies failure. So the idea of liberation, which is called moksha, is the ideal of Hindu life. Wake up, it's a dream. And in time, there is no hope in time. Everything is going to get worse in time. Because, as you know, it does. We all fall apart in the end. Everything falls apart. Institutions, buildings, nations, it all crumbles. And people say, well, that's an awfully pessimistic philosophy. Well, is it? I would rather say that the people who have hope in the future are the miserable people. Because they're like donkeys chasing carrots that are dangled before their noses from sticks attached to their collars. And they pursue in vain, always hoping that tomorrow will be the great thing, and therefore incapable of enjoying themselves today. People who live for the future never get there. Because when their plans mature, they are not there to enjoy them. They're the sort of people who spend their lives saving for their old age and trying to teach their children to do the same thing so that when they retire at 65, you know, they have false teeth and wrinkles and prostate trouble and all that sort of thing. Where were you going? What did you think it was all about? Furthermore, the fact that life is transient is part of its liveliness. The poets, in speaking of the transience of the world, always utter their best poetry. You know, our revels now are ended, and these, our actors, as I foretold you, are all spirits and are melted into air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great earth itself, aye, all which it inherits shall dissolve. And like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind.